You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 15th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
It's a little bit of a short list then this week, isn't
it? I know.
It sounded different.
Bob is having a work emergency, so he is not available this evening. Occasionally he gets called, like, last minute. He's got to do some software build or something. And, yeah, he's just not available.
Wrong. He's a CIA agent. He'll never admit it.
Yeah.
Or that's the other working hypothesis, but he'll never confirm it. Yeah,
that would be cool. Wouldn't it be cool to find out when you're old?
Wouldn't it?
That, like, one of your friends was a secret agent their whole life?
We had in our family a cousin. It was a cousin of my father's who would show up at occasional family events now and again. Never spoke much to the rest of the family. Was not married as far as we know. Had no children as far as we knew. Someone got tipped off at some point that he was working for the U.S. government in some secret capacity. And after a while, we just lost all contact with him, like around 1985 or so, when I was about 15 years old. That was kind of the last we had heard from him. So it's this big mystery in our family. Who was this guy?
Whoa.
Was he even a family member?
Yes. Yes, he was. He was. He was my father's cousin or second cousin.
Yeah, my wife has a second cousin who, same situation where, like, everyone knows that he, quote unquote, works for the government, but that's it. Like, he'll say, I can't say anything further about what my job is. So he basically is a spy.
Right.
But, like, you can't, there's just no information. And, like, he goes to Germany and, you know what I mean? Like, he travels around and everything. So probably works for one of the agencies, probably the CIA, but you just can't discuss it.
Oh, but I always wanted to know. I mean, just, you know, yeah. It's like, come on, somebody somewhere has to, something's written down somewhere about this guy.
Yeah.
You'll probably find out when he dies.
He may be gone already.
Even then.
You're right.
No.
Because they don't like to reveal methods and stuff, so.
Yeah.
That stuff.
Did you guys see that Werner Herzog documentary about you remember the agent who, like, threw himself out the window that they were, like, testing LSD on?
Yes.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah. Very interesting.
Yeah.
I know someone that that flies drone missions.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Whoa.
That's rough.
He or she cannot confirm or deny anything. But, right.
Oh, I'm sure.
So you ask questions and they just look at you like, don't, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, come on, dude, just tell me, like, what, you know, and like, there's just no information. You get nothing.
No. I mean, occasionally we'll get an email from an SGU listener who will tell us they're in the military, but they won't tell us exactly where they are or what they're doing, or they'll say, like, I'm in a submarine under the ocean. I can't tell you exactly where, those kinds of things.
But love the show.
Yeah, right. But hey,
we're attacking from the north. We're flying in under their radar on the movie Airplane.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, when will you be home? I can't tell you that. It's classified. Yeah, it gives every detail of the mission. But that movie was hilarious.
It's still good.
Before we get on with the show, I do want to touch on a couple of things. So we're getting to that 6-week mark before our book launches on October 2nd. This is when, the publishers start to get, you know, a little antsy about promoting the book. We're in the midst of planning our book tour, as it were. We're going to be starting probably at Comic-Con. That's in the final stages of negotiation. Comic-Con New York. We'll make the official announcement once that is official. Then we're going to England and we're going to be doing a bunch of things. So in case you haven't heard or you need reminding, our book is The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. It is basically an introduction to skepticism, but also a thorough treatment of all of the principles of skepticism that we talk about on the show. So it's a good reference for experienced skeptics and a good introduction for people who may be just at the beginning of their process of thinking about metacognition and science and critical thinking and all that good stuff that we talk about. So we're all really excited about it. We're very proud of the book that we produced. It was a lot of work, but we think it's going to be well received. It's getting great reviews, you know, not just from, you know, the people that we asked to blurb the book, but there was, like, the Kirkus review, which is an industry insider review. So that was sort of the first neutral review, meaning not somebody that we know. And it was really positive. We posted it on our Facebook page. It was really exciting to read that. So that's great. And it was a starred review, which is uncommon. You know, not all books get a starred review. So
yay.
We're very happy about that. So what we'd like you to do if you like listening to our show, if you like this stuff, I think you will really enjoy the book. You can go to our homepage at theskepticsguide.org. You will see a picture of the book cover there. Just click on that. That will take you to our Amazon page, but also we have a page dedicated to the book, skepticsguide.org/book. There is a navigation tab called book. Just click on that. So that has links to all the places where you could order it online. And we're also putting in the reviews and the blurbs are going there as well. So, and also you can order it from your local independent bookstore. We like that as well. It's good to support your local bookstore. The book is available for pre-order in hardcover or the electronic version, the ebook. We are in the midst of negotiations for the audiobook. But yeah, the ebook and the hardcover are available for pre-order. So if you are planning on getting the book or getting it as a gift for somebody, we do ask that you pre-order it because that will help launch the book and really helps promote the book, you know, because all those pre-orders count in the first week of sales.
Yeah, and the first week of sales is what gives you, you know, that's what gets you on lists, like, you know, New York Times bestsellers list as an example. Like if we sold enough books to get there, then our publisher will actually put a lot more energy into marketing the book. So it's a, you know, it's a snowball effect.
Yeah, the books, oh yeah, the success of books like this, you basically either succeed or fail in the first 2 weeks from the launch date. So that's where the pre-orders are critical. If we get, you know, to a certain threshold, then definitely that will help, you know, make the book a success. So we really do appreciate it. And I think, you know, if you're like listening to the show, I think you're going to love the book. So check it out. If you have not done so already, go to our book page and all the information that you need is right there. Jay, we're selling also just very quickly, we're selling tickets online to our DragonCon private show that's almost sold out. So if you want to grab a ticket, there's a couple left. The QED private show is sold out. Again, those events tend to sell out fairly quickly. And there are tickets available for the Extravaganza. So the Extravaganza is a stage show that we do with George Traub. We've done it 5 times now, I think. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of fun. It's a great show. We enjoy it. The audience loves it. It's just like a science critical thinking stage extravaganza show.
And it's a variety
so
show.
Fun.
It's a variety show, yeah.
It's loosely based on just improv bits.
Yeah.
That we do. There's a lot of audience interaction. There's one part which we love, which is the SGU versus the rest of you, which means that the whole audience gets into a trivia contest where the SGU acts as one and the audience, everyone out there individually is trying to beat us, but we have to beat the entire audience.
Yeah.
That's right.
And we usually do. No, I think we lost one time.
Except that one time.
Yeah, so I think we're four and one. Yeah. It's but a good demonstration of the, you know, there's two different ways of, you know, the crowdsourcing. You have 200 individuals or 300 individuals versus 5 people all working together.
Right.
Yeah. And they're all independent.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's pretty close, but yeah, but we have managed to win 4 out of 5 times, but it is a lot of fun.
If you go to theskepticsguide.org in the upper navigation, just click events and you'll see our 3 events there. And just pick the Skeptical Extravaganza.
Right. Go to the Skeptical Extravaganza of Special Significance, and there you'll be able to buy your ticket. That's the Thursday night before QED.
No, we'll do a book signing, meet and greet time after the show to say hi to everyone that came. And don't forget, George is hosting this. This is, you know, George is the host of the Skeptical Extravaganza, and he is gearing up, man. George and I had an awesome meeting this week already going over the whole thing. We are psyched.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun.
It always is.
Yeah, but we'll hang out, you know, afterwards to do a book signing then. Absolutely. All right, well, let's move on with the show. Carrie, you're going to start with what's the word?
What is the word? I think this word this week is kind of continuing our semi-theme, not doing it in any sort of particular order, but talking about common philosophy terms. So we have talked about epistemology in the past. We've talked about hermeneutics. What are some of the other ones we've done? Can you guys remember?
What was that one we did? Were you like, was it scissoring or like?
What?
Excuse me.
You know, what's that one? Is it a striate? You're going to triangulate?
Stridulation?
Stridulation.
Yes, that was a word I've done, but that was not a philosophy term. I love this show. Okay, well, this week we're going to talk about phenomenology. And phenomenology it was recommended by Jeff in Palatine, Illinois, I think. He said, I ran across the following word in a popular science article with regards to whether lobsters feel pain. The word is phenomenological. It feels like I've heard Steve use it before, and it may have meaning in the skeptical community as it relates to treatment of nonspecific ailments to which woo runs rampant. I think it may explain some of the effects of placebos. Here is the paragraph from which it came. The problem with pain is that it's phenomenological, which is a fancy philosophical term for something made real just by the fact that someone experiences it. If you think you're in pain, then you are, blah, blah, blah. So I think that's a good entree, but there's much more to be said about phenomenology. And really, the definition is sort of in the term. So it is one of those, I think, words where it's kind of easy to keep straight what it is. Especially a lot of philosophy terms can get kind of complicated in your head. But phenomenology is the study of phenomena. And what we're talking about there is the experience or awareness of external phenomena. But it really is the study of consciousness, the study of experience from this first person point of view. So the way that people, us humans, generally we're speaking about humans, experience the world around them. So, you know, a lot of people will talk about things like meaning or value coming from lived experience. They'll talk about aesthetics. They'll talk about abstractions. But a lot of this has to be based in this description of, let's say, qualia, of perspective, of intentionality, of consciousness. Phenomenology as a study was first really, I mean, it's hard to say where it was first described because it has an ancient Greek root, you know, logos, ology. We've heard that a lot, a study of or a science of or an account of, a speech of. But the phenomenon, the sort of first part of the word, does come from the ancient Greek, which translates to manifest or to show itself. I think a lot of people like to point to Heidegger, who wrote a book, Introduction to Phenomenological Research, in the 18th century. So Husserl may have been the first to use it from a philosophical standpoint, but Heidegger really built on that. These are what we often think of as like kind of existential philosophers. Phenomenology is used heavily in psychology. We talk about phenomenology a lot. And in a way, it sort of does extend to some of the conversations that we've had about postmodernism on the show, which can get really hairy. I know, Steve, you have a very strong line in the sand when it comes to postmodernism.
Well, yes. I mean, I think it should not apply to facts, you know, right?
There you go. That's a good way to look at it. Yes, yeah. It should not apply to external facts, because what we're talking about is the idea of a constructed reality when we talk about postmodernism, which is obviously linked to this core central idea of phenomenology. It's very difficult I'm training to be a psychotherapist right now, and it's very difficult because this idea of postmodernism is kind of important if you want to understand the world through the eyes of your patient. But at the same time, you're right, you have to find that balance between seeing things through their perspective and things that are fundamentally, I don't know if you want to say unknowable, but things that are fundamentally
subjective.
Yeah. Versus
as opposed
things that
to
are
empirical.
Knowable.
Yeah.
Or empirical.
If,
yes.
You have a factual question that has an empirical answer. You know, that's not, postmodernism does not really apply to that. And I think that's where it goes off the rails. I have nothing against postmodernism in general. It's just saying that, well, science isn't real, or science has no special significance, or no privileged relationship to the truth. Well, yeah, it does, because it follows a valid method.
Exactly. And you see that on a continuum, right? You see the people who try to say that, like, it was when it comes to epistemology, which is another philosophy term that we've talked about previously, you know, the study of knowing things, how we know what we know. Some people will throw science in there. Oh, it's just one of many epistemologies that are all equally valid, which, you're right, that's a very postmodern view that's quite dangerous. And then there are people who will talk about it as one of many epistemologies that is dependent on the situation. And so science is very good for empiricism, obviously. It's kind of the only by far the best, kind of the only. But when it comes to things that are subjective, and that's why I think coming back to the email recommendation from our good friend here, Jeff in Palatine, Illinois, it's interesting that he brought up, and I think it's a really good insight that it may explain some of the effects of placebos. It's important for the skeptical community to understand phenomenology as it relates to the treatment of nonspecific ailments, where we start to see a lot of woo.
So, Kara, in medicine, at least in neurology, we mm-hmm. use the term phenomenology to mean something completely different.
Really?
Yeah.
That's awesome, because that doesn't even show up in dictionary definitions.
Yeah, so I mean, it has a very specific use in clinical neurology. So we use the term phenomenology to talk about translating what the patient experiences into a specific neurological phenomenon. So like if the patient says, I have difficulty walking, that's their experience. That's not mm-hmm. a neurological symptom. If you have to translate that into ataxia, for example, which is mm-hmm. a specific neurological phenomenon. And if you don't get the phenomenology right at the first level, then everything that follows is going to be hopelessly misguided. It's going to be wrong.
Because sometimes people walk, like if somebody says, I have a hard time walking, you don't know if it's weakness, pain,
right.
coordination problems, all
those. It could be a dozen things. You have to decide what is the thing that's causing their difficulty walking. What phenomenon are they trying to express to us? Yeah. Then you localize, and then you come up with an etiology. What's causing the problem?
Interesting. It seems like that's also probably really heavily used in neuropsychology, because in neuropsych, right, they're not running scans. They're usually taking the data that you've already mm-hmm. gathered as a neurologist, and then they're working with the client later to kind of implement both their assessments mm-hmm. of these phenomenological experiences, implement that into kind of treatment strategies and rehabilitation and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, so psychiatry is obviously trying very hard to develop fundamental phenomenology to explain what patients complain of, right? We mm-hmm. know what patients complain about, but we want to understand them phenomenologically. What is actually going on in the brain that is producing that when patients feel depressed? What is that?
Yeah.
What
it's
is depression?
It's so difficult, too, because
it assumes
that this isn't – that there is like either a single etiology, or that these things aren't all like kind of mixed together. And you can have somebody who's depressed because of an external experience, because of an internal neurological issue. There's so many different reasons. And also, is what they're calling depression what you might consider clinical depression?
Right.
Or is it a depressed mood that's not atypical?
Hmm. Right.
Yeah. So complicated.
Yeah, what patients call depression may be phenomenologically several different things. And mm-hmm. how we approach it, how we think about it, how we research it, how we treat it may differ depending on what it really is. But of course, we don't really fully know what all the most base level phenomenology is for a lot of psychiatric things. Neurologically, it depends, but there are a lot, some we do, some we don't.
Yeah.
But that's always the goal, is to describe phenomenologically what's going on as best as possible and then proceed from there.
And that's why that kind of the psychiatric world is there. I mean, you see it split and lumped into a lot of different areas depending on who the practitioners and the theorists are.
Yeah.
But you do often see a big push-pull between a more kind of biomedical view and mm-hmm. a much more kind of social psychological view.
That's true.
Because I mean, schizophrenia, for example, is a very good biomedical basis. Like we have a lot of good or dementia, for example. But then on the flip side of that, something like depression or anxiety, ooh, lordy, it is very hard to pin that down.
All right, let's move on with some news items. So there's a good article came out. I wrote about it on Neurologica about the Dunning-Kruger effect for anti-vaccine attitudes. You guys remember the Dunning-Kruger effect,
sure,
right?
Sure, of course, yeah.
I am smarter than everyone else.
Yeah, so the Dunning-Kruger, so there already is, right, as a quick review, and this is the kind of thing we do a deep dive on in our book, by the way. But the Dunning-Kruger effect refers specifically to the fact that the less somebody knows about a topic, the greater they overestimate their knowledge on that topic. And the lines of actual like testing performance and self-assessment cross at around the 80 percentile marks. In other words, people who performed in the top 20%, top 20 percentile, actually underestimate their ability a little bit. But below 80%, everyone overestimates themselves and everyone thinks they're in the top half, right? Nobody thinks they're below 50%. Mm-hmm. So there is a general overconfidence effect that goes on. Most people will overestimate their ability in most things, right? That's just a generic overconfidence effect. But the Dunning-Kruger effect refers to the fact that it relates to their actual knowledge or ability in that area where, you know, at the lower end of the ability scale, they overestimate their ability by more and more and more. So what the researchers were looking at was, does this Dunning-Kruger effect apply to attitudes about vaccines? So what they did was they surveyed a lot of people, 1,300 Americans. They gave a questionnaire. So it's a reasonably good survey. And they found that 34% of U.S. adults in their sample felt that they knew as much or more than scientists about the causes of autism.
Really? Wow.
Think about that.
Yeah.
And 36%, you know, the same or more than medical doctors. So basically about a third, 35% thought they knew more than scientists and doctors about the causes of autism.
Is that like, is that
beyond
hubris?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
is
that's
it?
Crazy that's is what
hubris.
That is.
But is it? It yeah. must be some sort of weird combination of hubris mixed with like a deep distrust of the medical quote unquote establishment, right?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. It's the Google University phenomenon, I think. It is the distrust of medical establishment, and it is the illusion of knowledge. So remember, we talked about Dunning, who of Dunning-Kruger effect fame, in a follow-up paper wrote this quote, which I think is excellent. He wrote, "An ignorant mind is precisely not a spotless empty vessel, but one that's filled with the clutter of irrelevant or misleading life experiences, theories, facts, intuitions, strategies, algorithms, heuristics, metaphors, and hunches that regrettably have the look and feel of useful and accurate knowledge."
Oh, gosh, that's so good.
So good. I
yeah,
know.
So people
it's an illusion.
Are full of the illusion of knowledge.
Yep.
And the internet makes that illusion much more compelling.
Yeah, right. Well, Steve, don't forget too, you know, they also feel like they have special knowledge, like they have the inside secret track. There's a little bit of conspiracy thinking in here.
Yeah.
You're right. And we're not done. So let's go a little bit further into the numbers. So that's just taking all comers. However, he said they also found that 62% of those who performed the worst on their autism knowledge test believed that they knew as much or more than scientists and doctors, compared to only 15% of those who scored the best. So that's the Dunning-Kruger effect. It wasn't just that these people think they know as much as scientists and doctors, but that it scaled with their actual knowledge. So the most of those people actually scored the lowest on just a generic test of knowledge of autism. And whereas the people who knew the most about it were the least likely to say that they knew as much or more than scientists. I don't know if some of them probably were, you know, doctors or scientists, which is why they scored so well.
Yeah, wouldn't that be funny if there's like one dude in there who's like, I am the world leader in autism research.
You get a pass. They also found that 71% of those who strongly endorse misinformation about the link between vaccines and autism feel they knew as much or more than doctors and scientists, compared to only 20% who reject the misinformation. So again, it correlates strongly with ignorance of autism and believing that vaccines cause autism.
And you go and immerse yourself in an echo chamber on the internet, it'll just keep feeding back on you, and even reaffirming that even more in these people that they're correct.
Well, yeah, because one of the core talking points there is that these are the things that doctors are hiding from you, the things they don't want you to know. Or the things that they have the wool over their eyes.
They totally talk about like being like literate doctors. Like, there are doctors who are woke, right? Who know about autism or whatever it is, whatever the woo is that they're pushing. And that the most rank and file doctors don't know about it. And what they're really talking about is the fringe doctors who accept their bullshit, right? And they think that they know more than all the other doctors.
Yep.
So that's part of the echo chamber. Yeah, and you're right, Evan. This is partly an echo chamber effect as well. Again, this is not caused by the internet. This is just facilitated by it. This I think has always existed.
It's gas on the fire.
Yeah. And I think it's also exacerbated by just the overall death of expertise, right? Just the idea that the downgrading of the generic respect that people have for expertise itself.
Yeah.
Sure. Because I think, I do think it's just that Dunning is exactly correct. The biggest problem here is the illusion of knowledge that is so easy to be created by a little knowledge. I mean, this idea of a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. And that's kind of a simplistic aphorism, but in this case, it's exactly correct. It's because it gives you this illusion that you actually know what you're talking about. But that's where the term sophomoric comes from, right? It's like sophomores are not freshmen, so they think they know everything, right?
Yeah.
Because they have just a little bit of knowledge.
And it does seem to kind of feed into to this kind of modern movement that's very anti-media, that's very, quick to call something fake news, regardless of, you know, just because you disagree with it.
Yes, that's right. That dismissing anything you don't like as it's you're a shill, it's fake news. It's a conspiracy. Yeah,
because there's this lack of respect for the journalistic process, too. Like the same way there's a lack of respect for physicians or for professors, people who have dedicated their lives. There's also a lack of respect for the hard work that journalists do to write good stories.
It does correlate strongly with lack of knowledge, right? And in believing conspiracies. The people who know more are more humble. Knowledge correlates with humility, and ignorance correlates with this illusion of knowledge and having the hubris to think that you know more than freaking scientists.
Mm-hmm.
For me, and recently, the poster child of all of this is flat earthers, right?
Yeah.
If you want to see how far can this phenomenon go, that's how far. Right now, I think they're the reigning champions of Dunning-Kruger is the flat earthers. They win.
Yeah, so you may have seen this on the internet, guys. There's a quote going around. One of the first things that a serial liar wants to do is undermine your trust in the providers of fact that would check his lies.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Oh, yeah. We put that on our Facebook page. That was from a philosopher, right, who was talking about the reason why people are attacking journalism and facts and experts or whatever is because it's a preemptive strike against the people who could call you on your bullshit.
Yep.
I made that observation about the alternative medicine movement at least 20 years ago. That they trump up this conspiracy by doctors because doctors are the very people who know enough to call them out on their bullshit. So it's a preemptive strike. That's what they're doing. And that's what I think we're just seeing now applied more generally is this preemptive strike against experts and scientists and people who should know better because they're the ones who have the specific knowledge and the experience.
And look at the places it can lead you to anti-vaccination. I mean, lives at stake. Literally.
Ugh.
All right. Well, before we move on to our next news item, someone is joining us.
Who is it?
It's Bob.
About time you showed up, punk.
They let you out of your cage tonight, Bob?
Tesla cage. Boy, so many possible jokes, but I will say nothing.
Hey, Bob.
Yes, I'm out of my cage. Rattle, rattle. What?
Bob, Robert from Discord. Robert from our Discord server. You know, the Discord server.
Yeah.
When you become a patron. He wants a quickie with Bob.
Ooh. Oh, boy. Well, thank you, Bob. This one's going to be a little bit – it's going to sound like a little bit like auto-erotica, but that's okay. Thanks, Bob. This is your quickie with Bob.
See how that works, Kara?
Yeah. Huh? Now I get it.
Okay. Confirmation is in that scientists in South Korea and Japan have created Schwartzites.
May the Schwartzites be with you.
This is, first thing I thought, that, very good, Evan. This is the long sought third form of carbon nanostructures like graphene and fullerenes, something that theoretical chemists have worked on for decades. And this completes the trio of possible curvatures to graphene, positively curved, flat, and now negatively curved with the Schwartzites. So just for a little foundation here, graphene has zero curvature. That's a carbon atoms arranged like a flat sheet of chicken wire all over the news the past 10, 15 years. Amazing possibilities for applications in science, computers, electronics. I mean, just so many possibilities. You don't even know where it's going to end. Still kind of waiting for some of the killer applications of graphene, but it's weird how it's kind of assumed, this is just going to happen. It's just going to take a little time. Then you've got the fullerenes. They have positive curvature. They're spherical carbon cages that are used today. There's actually some good applications for this stuff. They use them to deliver drugs and genes, to people. If you roll graphene into into a cylinder, you create another type of fullerene called a nanotube, something, another term that's deeply embedded in science culture these days. So both of these discoveries were so dramatic that they each were awarded their own Nobel Prize in 96 and 2010. So I have high hopes for this third one. This is the last one, negatively curved schwartzites. They've been compared. If you're trying to picture it, I was trying to describe it. You can kind of picture it like soap bubbles on a wire frame, kind of like a topologically minimal surface. Check it out online. Very beautiful imagery for what these schwartzites look like, even though if the name isn't quite as cool as graphene or fullerene. So possibilities. Chemists predict that schwartzites should have unique electronic, optical, and magnetic properties, ideal for things like supercapacitors, battery electrodes, catalysts. And since they have large internal spaces, they could be great for gas storage and separation as well. So that is all I got. This has been your Quickie with Bob. I hope it was good for you too, Bob.
Bob, have they actually made the stuff or just described its shape?
No. They've made it. They found it kind of accidentally. It was kind of serendipitous. But they were looking at these new byproducts of some process, and it took some examination because, I mean, these things are 10,000 times thinner than your hair. So submicroscopic, very tiny, and they had to be specifically confirmed by another group of scientists that they had actually found it. So now they're making them and they're diving in. They're diving in trying to find applications and seeing what they could do. I mean, this is essentially another type of graphene or fullerene or nanotube. I mean, who knows what this last one could be applied to.
Yeah, the pictures are beautiful. And, yeah. You know, did you manage to find out why schwartzite?
The guy who predicted it, Schwartz. Schwartz dude.
Okay, figured.
Yep.
Schwartz dude.
Cleopatra Schwartz. It was Cleopatra Schwartz, right?
Wait, I don't get it. What's that from?
That's from Kentucky Fried Movie. From the 70s.
Whoa.
What?
From the airplane.
I've never even heard.
No, the people who produced Airplane produced that movie, I believe.
I've never even heard of that movie.
Kentucky Fried Movie?
Yeah.
It is the ideal movie for 13-year-old boys.
Yeah, we watched, I think we were more like 11 when we watched that movie, and that was like the peak age to watch a movie like that because it was that zany humor.
Stupid
like an
humor,
airplane.
Yeah.
Zany humor,
but it was
and gratuitous
filthy.
Nudity. Filthy.
And gratuitous nudity, yeah.
On top of all of that awesomeness for 11, 12, or 13-year-old, then you throw in a long segment that is a parody of Bruce Lee's Enter the Dragon, which was hilarious. I mean, what else
yes.
do you want?
Anything but that.
Okay. You were clearly not an 11-year-old boy.
So, Evan, tell me about this guy. He's publishing a book claiming that he was abducted by aliens like 50 years ago.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys ever heard of this fellow before. I hadn't, but he is part of UFO folklore in a sense. So the story goes like this. Two men, Calvin Parker and Charles Hickson, they claim they were abducted by extraterrestrials while fishing on the Pascagoula River in 1973. Now, the reason the story is in the news is that Calvin Parker has written a book about his alleged experience, which is apparently something he has been very reluctant to talk about over the decades. His book includes many, well, he obviously is testimonial and everything, but photos, documents, newspaper articles written throughout the years, and something else of particular interest, and I think quite telling about his story. The book contains a transcription of a hypnosis session he undertook. More on that in a minute. Let me give you the quick backstory. It was October 11, 1973, 6 o'clock in the evening. It had just started getting dark. It was kind of a bright moon, and these two fellows were out on the lake fishing. So Parker said that he noticed a blue light reflecting off the water. You know, fishing with his friend out on the water. Blue light. Okay. Realizing, though, that the light was coming from above them, and they looked up. And it was emanating from a craft, something like he had never seen before. Oh my gosh. It was hard to tell with the light so bright. This is him talking. But it looked like it was shaped like a football. I would say estimating it was about 80 feet in size, and it made very little sound. It was just a hissing noise. Parker then goes on to describe creatures, legless creatures, three of them that emerged from the craft and floated down towards he and his friend. He described one of the creatures as having no neck with gray wrinkled skin, and another one had a neck but appeared more feminine. The hands, or where the hands would be for these creatures, were shaped like mittens or crab claws. One of the creatures put out one of its claws and wrapped around his arm. He was terrified, but a sensation came over his body. And this is him speaking again. I think they injected us with something to calm us down. I was kind of numb and went along with the program. Yep. Parker said that the creatures floated he and his friend Hickson into the craft and performed physical examinations on them. And then they were taken back to the riverbank and unceremoniously dumped there. And that's the story. Now, for 2 weeks after the incident, they kept it to themselves. But then they decided to contact the Jackson County Sheriff's Office and made an official report.
Oh, gosh. What do they do with that when that happens? You know, it's so sad. Like, again, okay,
also,
partner.
Also, you know, 1973, there was actually, you know, quite a bit of this sort of stuff going on in the culture in the 70s. UFO, people seeing things, a lot of stories. The whole Project Blue Book investigation into UFOs was not that far in the past at that time. So UFOs were definitely on the mind and the conscious of people in the country at that time, certainly. It was pretty well talked about. So after they made their report, almost immediately, they said the news spread like wildfire, and it became this worldwide story. Now, I had, again, not heard of it before, but apparently it is a well-known story in UFO circles. And
yeah,
for this sort of
it's basically, I've heard of it before. Yeah, it's considered like the second most famous abduction story.
Besides the Betty and Barney Hill story, yeah, would be exactly. Number one, and this would be number two. Okay, so here's where it gets a little interesting. Here's where the hypnosis part comes into it. So they were contacted days later by ufologist James Harder and another fellow, J. Allen Hynek. Now, Hynek is the fellow who coined the term close encounter, right? And the close encounter classification system, for which we obviously know was then adapted into the movie by Steven Spielberg. So, and the two of them went and interviewed the two men. James Harder then attempted to hypnotize them. And basically, this is apparently what the transcript is the session itself and what came out in that session. Harder and Hynek both commented that they had definitely experienced an extraterrestrial phenomenon and that it was a genuine, frightening experience for them. That was the result. That was their analysis of their interview with them after putting them under hypnosis. Now, Dr. Harder, he's an engineer. Right. He's not a psychologist. He's not a psychiatrist. He's not a medical doctor. He's an engineer, but he's also a prominent UFO researcher who has a lot of history, obviously, for decades having researched UFOs. So this was kind of in his wheelhouse in a certain sense. He was the primary investigator on a number of classic UFO cases related to alien abductions, including this one. Also, 1975, the Travis Walton case, which is a famous case. And of course, he took over the Betty and Barney Hill abduction investigation and continued it many, many years after it had actually happened.
When you say like he was the primary investigator, you mean this is like his like funded research or like he's just like looking up stuff on his
own
computer?
He and his organization are the driving force behind it.
I feel like the term primary investigator is like misleading because it makes it sound like it's institutional.
Well, you know.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. It's like just for himself.
Right.
Yeah, it's like this is just, he's not like a lead researcher. Or like it. He's
no,
not
that's
the primary investigator. Yeah.
You know, really, I mean, what are we talking about here?
But those are like those. That's what pseudoscientists do.
Oh, absolutely.
They take legitimate sounding stuff.
Yep. Remote viewing, among other things, are in Harder's belief system. And he also believes that aliens have underground bases at four locations on the Earth. So you kind of get a sense where he's kind of coming from with his preconceived notions. So he basically, through hypnosis, got them to recant their tell their story, bring out the details about what had actually happened, and there it was. But Parker was never really became sort of famous overnight in a sense, but hated it, and he shied away from it. He said that he changed jobs, he relocated to other towns, and wanted to just keep all of this really to himself. He feels like, in a sense, he was kind of used by all this, did not want to be in the spotlight at all. But recently, he wrote the book. His wife convinced him, you know, you're getting older, and nobody really knows your story, you really need to put it out there for people. So that's what he did.
So now Joe Nickel had a good published a good analysis of this case in 2012 in the Skeptical Inquirer, and I think he's basically spot on. If you know, he dredges up some other details from the early reporting. Initially, it seems like, you know, so first of all, these two guys were drinking and fishing and fell asleep, right? Calvin Parker initially said, he told the police that he fell asleep and, or quote unquote, passed out and then woke up after the whole thing was over. So he slept through this entire UFO encounter, mm-hmm. right? All the details come from Hixon, from the older guy. Charles Hixon was, I think, 40s at the time. Yeah. Parker was 19. Yeah. And Hixon died, you know, some time ago. And Hixon reports a pretty typical hypnagogic episode where he was paralyzed. He was floating. You know, he had this, which he described at the time, like it was something like in a dream, you know? And then he probably then, you know, woke up his younger companion, told them what happened, and it became a folie à deux, right? It just became a shared delusion at that point. And then, you know, you know how you personalize memories. Parker probably does actually have a memory of this all happening because he just personalized the memory, the story that was given to him by Hixon. So it's just, you know, Parker was asleep. Hixon had a hypnagogic episode, and the whole thing gets blown up into a UFO encounter, mm-hmm. you know? And now we're going on 40, 50-year-old memories that are worthless. It's like the grassy knoll, right? You know, the woman who, right after Kennedy was shot, said her report, her eyewitness report was, I didn't see a thing. And then over the years, she developed this memory, this false memory of this, with elaborate details about chasing somebody into the grassy knoll and all this stuff. But at the time, she said, I didn't see a thing. At the time, Parker said, I kind of slept through the whole thing. You know, he had no information. And now he has enough information to write a whole book about it, apparently. right. But this is what happens. Yeah.
But these are also unsinkable rubber ducks in a certain sense, is that they're always there and they never really go away.
Well, how can you falsify it, right? There's no physical evidence. There's no tape or recording or picture or anything to investigate. Literally, all we have is stories of these two guys have to tell. Stories that occurred around drinking and sleeping, you know, right. Which is always a red flag with details that follow a pretty typical hypnagogic scenario. That's it. That's all we have.
And even if they believe
there's
it,
nothing else.
It doesn't matter because, you know, we can fool ourselves. As we have learned over the years, you know, our memories are so unreliable. Our ability to even process the things that we've seen is unreliable. So,
yeah, Parker probably believes everything.
And it doesn't even take 45 years of a past event to go that far in which your memory can be altered or manipulated. Hours can pass by and you can be influenced by so many things and wind up totally misremembering events.
Yeah. And also, when they were in the police station, they have recordings of them being left in the room by themselves, and they were comparing details. They were comparing notes.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So they were contaminating their testimony. So if the details line up, it's because they were talking to each other. That's why you're not supposed to allow witnesses to be exposed to each other, you know?
Yeah.
Because of that contamination. Anyway, very, very common.
Yep.
All right, Kara, do I have to worry about smallpox? I thought we eradicated this already.
All of the above.
Okay.
All right, explain yourself.
Okay, so there's a new editorial in Nature, just came out a couple days ago, August 13th, about smallpox called The Specter of Smallpox Lingers, which is quite the powerful headline. So we do know that the last person to be infected with smallpox, her name was, she was a researcher, actually. Her name was Janet Parker. She was a researcher.
No relation.
No relation to who?
To the guy we just talked about.
Oh.
UFO guy.
Hey, we don't know. Does he have British ties? We don't know. Yeah, she's a researcher in Birmingham, and she actually Actually, she was a medical photographer, but she worked in a lab upstairs from a smallpox lab. She was admitted to the hospital August 11th, 1978. She had lesions and scars, and she's the last known person to have come down with smallpox. And that's because the lab was utilizing it, and they were using what they thought was proper protocol, but it made its way through the air vents.
Oh,
obviously, protocol. Yeah, I know, right? Rough. She died 1 month later, and that was the last known person. So by 1980, the World Health Organization declared it eradicated worldwide. So yes, Steve, you're right. Smallpox is eradicated worldwide. There's not been a case since 1980. That's a really big deal because it's 2018 already. But the FDA last month approved a drug to treat it. Seems weird, but there's good reason for that. So let's talk about the drug first. It's an antiviral drug. People had used antivirals previously when they were infected with smallpox, but they weren't targeted. They were kind of non-specific. So previously, if you were infected with smallpox, I mean, the best thing would be to not get infected, right? To be vaccinated. But previously, if you were infected, there were some antivirals. But they weren't specific. There's a new antiviral. It's called TPOX or Tecovirimat. And it's made by a drug company in New York City, and it actually inhibits the proteins within our own cells that allow the virus to spread. Smallpox, of course, is caused by variola virus. There's variola major and variola minor, and there are different symptoms that come with both. But most people get variola major when they used to get it, and it mostly was awesome at killing and making people be in a lot of pain. This drug, which is kind of interesting, it's never actually been tested on humans. But the FDA has approved it. And the reason it's never been tested on humans, at least in terms of its ability to cure smallpox, is because humans don't have smallpox and they're not going to infect a human with smallpox to see how well this works. That would be an epidemiological nightmare. But they have tried it on monkeys and rabbits with a similar form called monkeypox and rabbitpox. And it was 90% effective. So this was just published in the New England Journal of Medicine. I have a copy of it here, called Oral Tecovirimat for the Treatment of Smallpox. And so I think the big question is, like, why are we coming up with an antiviral for a disease that's been eradicated? What do you guys think?
Because it might come back.
Terrorism.
Yeah, so yeah. It might come back because of, who just said terrorism?
I did, terrorism.
Yeah, exactly. So this is a disease similar to poliovirus where it requires a human reservoir. So the fact that it is eradicated means it's not like Ebola. It's not always existing in the wild because it's not zoonotic. So whereas we can never eradicate Ebola, we just have to treat these little pop-ups every time they occur. With smallpox, similar to a wild-type poliovirus, which we're pretty close to eradicating, once it's gone, we have good reason to believe that it's gone. It does not exist within a human population and will not unless it's somehow released, and it could be released in multiple ways. We do know that there is variola virus in the U.S. Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, that's in Atlanta, and at Vector, which is kind of the Russian version of the CDC, which is in Novosibirsk. Novosibirsk. We'll pretend that was good Russian.
Novosibirsk.
Thank you. That's so perfect.
Hey, what the hell?
And there's an organization called the World Health Assembly. They convene often to talk about, like every couple of years, to talk about whether or not we should destroy them. Each time people argue that it's probably not a good idea to destroy them because we need them to be able to do research. Because even if all of the variola virus were destroyed that we know of, there's a chance there could be variola somewhere that we don't know about. For example, in 2014, we found livestock in a freezer at the NIH. Nobody knew they were there. They just lost track of it. And then they were like, holy crap, there's a freezer full of smallpox. Let's be better about this. And so that also opens up possibilities of, like, during Cold War Russia, are there, you know, stocks of smallpox in different freezers that people either don't know about or never informed people of? Are there countries that have smallpox stocks that have never told the globe because of the potential for bioterrorism. And even beyond that, through obviously this kind of new field of synthetic biology, we've seen some pretty interesting stuff happen. In 2006, Canadian researchers made horsepox from DNA that they ordered online. They were able to find pieces of DNA from different biomedical companies and put it together and create horsepox. So there's no real reason why, with a little bit of creativity and a lot of hard work, we couldn't produce a synthetic smallpox. And that could be even more dangerous, right? Because it could be engineered to be more virulent, yeah, for example, to spread more easily. Also, apparently, smallpox could lie dormant in mummies, because we know that smallpox existed in ancient Egypt. Like, smallpox is a super old disease, and we found traces like tens of thousands of years ago. And there's a chance that, for example, as permafrost melts, as, you know, we find these archaeological sites in places that were protected previously, we could encounter potentially dormant cases of smallpox in corpses.
The next Iceman could have smallpox.
Exactly. Uh-oh. And the researchers who discover him could contract smallpox, which is really scary, right? Because smallpox is a really, really rough disease. Like, it's got a high mortality rate. It's incredibly painful. 3 out of 10 people with smallpox died. That's high. That's a lot of people. And even people who lived usually had scars, facial scarring, scarring all over their body, blindness. Not very good outcomes. Now, the last outbreak in the U.S. was as far back as 1949. So, you know, it's not a everyday threat, but the threat of bioterrorism through smallpox exists. And that's why these drug companies argue that it is important to develop basically a quote-unquote antidote, you know, an antiviral that, in case if somebody is exposed, whether it be in a lab or through some sort of bioterrorism, you know, a disgruntled employee. That's what they think happened, you remember, with the anthrax attacks. And so there's a secondary company that's also developing a drug. It's called Brincidofovir. Oh, I said that weird. Brincidofovir, out of Durham, North Carolina. And that one got fast-tracked because it was designated, and maybe you know more about this, Steve, as an orphan drug, which I guess is a colloquial term for therapies for diseases that have a super, super small market.
It's not colloquial. It's technical.
Oh, it is a technical term.
Because there's an orphan drug law.
Gotcha.
So you have to be – it's like being an endangered species. It's an operational definition. You have to be declared an orphan drug by the FDA, and then that grants certain rights and privileges to the pharmaceutical company who develops drugs for an orphan disease.
Cool. Okay. So then smallpox, I guess, has been designated then as an orphan disease, right? Because nobody actually
It's the most orphan disease there is. It's non-existent.
Yeah. And so, but that means that we do have a drug that's about to come to market. It just got FDA approval, and another drug that's been fast-tracked. And yeah, so, you know, some people might argue that this is a waste of resources, but other people might argue that we should be definitely better safe than sorry, because smallpox is not something that any of us want to encounter within our lifetimes. It's actually probably one of the greatest, I mean, it's kind of been hailed as one of the greatest marvels of modern medicine, the fact that we were able to completely eradicate this. I mean, just Google it. Google images of smallpox.
No thanks.
And you'll be reminded of a time when you did not want to be alive.
My gosh.
I know. It's like we talk about
like plague and stuff.
Poliovirus. Yeah, exactly. And do you know why it's called smallpox? Because syphilis at the time caused...
Was the big pox?
Yeah, they called it the great pox.
Yeah.
And so this was designated as smallpox as to distinguish it from the great pox.
The other thing is they're keeping it in these labs. I mean, right, to study it in case it comes out, but having it in the lab is one of the risks of it coming out.
It's the main risk of it coming out.
Yeah, so maybe we should just try to completely get rid of it around everywhere.
Well, and maybe we could if and when we have enough vaccine and treatment on stock. You know what I mean? But like until those things are well established to work, it's going to be hard to get rid of it because you need it to start. It's the same thing when there's a new, you know, you watch these movies like Contagion or something, and it's like, why don't they have a pill for it? Why don't they? It's because they have to like take a sample and they have to grow it in the lab and they have to test it and they have to do all this stuff. We've already done all that.
Yeah.
So that's the important part of the research that takes a lot of time.
All right. Thanks, Kara. Mm-hmm. So the most asked question we got this week was definitely about the Roundup trial jury awarding it. So, yeah, so a California jury.
What the hell is going on with that?
Dwayne Johnson.
The Rock.
So the, yeah,
what, like the Rock.
No.
It's Dwayne.
Dwayne.
Not Dwayne. Yeah, so California jury awarded Dwayne Johnson $289 million in damages against Monsanto on the conclusion that Roundup caused his non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And most of that award was basically punitive damage, right? That was to punish Monsanto, right?
So they,
that sounds bad.
That was like the 90% of it.
So they don't give more people cancer? Like that's
right.
Steve, make me feel good about this. And this is a scary one.
So this, they're going to appeal it and we'll see what happens on the appeal. But this was a horrible decision because, you know, this is against the science. And this is an example of non-expert juries making emotional decisions, in my opinion, based upon very flawed, you know, legal process, rather than just having experts review the actual evidence and making, you know, all the evidence and making a decision. But in any case, the best data we have at this point does not support the conclusion that there's any correlation, any association between glyphosate or Roundup as a whole and any cancer. This is a lot of this stems from the IARC, of the World Health Organization, who a couple of years ago, 2015, declared glyphosate a probable carcinogen. But infamously, the guy who was in charge of that, Dr. Blair, did not include evidence from the largest study to date at the time of more than 50,000 farmers and their families showing no correlation, showing no evidence of a link between glyphosate exposure and cancer.
Was that he overlooked it or wasn't published?
No. Yeah. Well, he knew it existed. It was a lot of it was his own data. The publication of it was delayed and he didn't include it in the review, but he knew it. He knew the data. He was like totally panned for doing this.
Yikes.
And he said under oath, the data would have altered the IARC's analysis.
Mm. Oh, wow.
Of course it would, because it was the largest and best data we had to date and it was negative. Also, the IARC decision was an outlier. Pretty much every other expert panel that's reviewed the same evidence has come to the opposite conclusion that there is no correlation between glyphosate and NHL or non-Hodgkin's lymphoma specifically or any cancer.
But this was a jury trial, right?
Yeah, it was a jury trial.
Yeah, so none of that matters if the jury believes the arguments.
Yeah, so it's like who puts on a better dog and pony show, you know, the plaintiff or the defendant attorney. And it's a lot easier to scare people than to reassure them. You know what I mean? It's a lot easier to say there's something going on here in Monsanto. We all know how evil they are.
Well, yeah, to reinforce previously held beliefs, too. Like, I bet, there's a whole process of jury selection. Do you eat clean? Do you love organic food? I'm sure all those questions were asked before they chose their jury. Ugh.
So, yeah, it's unfortunate. And it is, you know, this could go the same way as silicone breast implants. Remember Dow Corning filed for bankruptcy because of just multiple class action lawsuits.
And the Audi automakers also were suffered greatly because of what was said to be a defect in their system, but it turned out it wasn't, but the damage was done to the company.
Right. And then, you know, after the bankruptcy of Dow Corning, then the definitive epidemiological studies came out and said, oh, never mind. It turns out there is no correlation between, you know, silicone breast implants and autoimmune disease.
Oh, thanks a lot.
Oops.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, but it's a little too late. And this is the same thing. You know, glyphosate, which is the main ingredient in Roundup. So one of the things that the lawyers did was they said, okay, so there's no evidence that glyphosate causes cancer. But what about the interaction of glyphosate with the other things in Roundup? It's the synergistic effect of the Roundup.
Oh,
and of course, there's no evidence for that.
But just
they
just made up.
They just moved the goalposts. It's like, oh, you've already disproven this. Well, maybe it was the Roundup. And there were other problems with the case, like the time between exposure and him being diagnosed with cancer was really short, probably too short for there to be any cause and effect. You know, I won't get into the legal issues of like, you know, he had accidental exposures and what the liability of that is, but just the science didn't support this jury's conclusion.
Well, and even beyond that, like these kinds of, it's so hard to prove links like this. This is emotional. It has to be.
Yeah, but so you're right, but you could argue that, well, people shouldn't be left out in the cold because the science hasn't proved the damages that they've suffered yet. But that's not the case here. This is the case of the science. We have the science, and it shows there is no link, you know? So this is not like, oh, this hasn't been studied yet. We don't know. Maybe it's possible.
Yeah, that's true. This isn't like Tom's River. I don't know if anybody read that book, but which goes deep into the epidemiology, trying to show brain cancer from this industrial dye complex, right, where it's like a really good chance, but just epidemiologically speaking, it's very hard to prove. It's not like that because we knew that there was a direct toxic effect of that dye. We know that there's no toxic effect of glyphosate. It's well established.
And the $289 million, I mean, that's a punishment. You know, that's not just, oh, maybe that this poor guy has cancer. Maybe it was caused by this. We don't know about it yet. Let's give him cover his healthcare costs. You know, this is, let's punish Monsanto for being evil.
Amazingly punitive. Well, here's a quarter of $1 billion. I mean, what would that do to Monsanto?
Which is now owned by Bayer, by the way.
Probably not much.
Monsanto doesn't exist anymore. Right. I mean, Monsanto was just absorbed by Bayer, and they got rid of the name.
Oh, they got rid of Monsanto as a name?
Yeah, yeah.
What do we call them?
It will always live Bayer. Oh, it's Bayer.
It's owned by Bayer, but they just have their division of whatever. But I don't know if they're going to come up with a different name. But yeah, the name Monsanto, mortuis est. So, but if this tanks glyphosate as an herbicide, the thing is, glyphosate replaced a lot of other herbicides that are actually toxic. You know, this is glyphosate's the least toxic herbicide that we have. And so this could have a negative impact on agriculture, on food production, and in fact, bring back more toxic herbicides. This is not a decision that should be made by 12 scientifically illiterate jurors in California, right? That they shouldn't have that effect on the agricultural infrastructure of the world. But they might. They just might based on that decision. They're going to appeal.
Sorry. Yeah. Appeal.
100%.
Yeah.
But we'll see how that goes.
You know, right? This reminds me of that book again. This is why the aliens are going to wipe us out, because we're stupid.
The universe can't take our existence anymore.
If aliens can get themselves to our planet with technology, whether we're smart or dumb doesn't matter. But I hear what you're saying. But
you clearly haven't read the book. Read the book, Jay.
What's it called?
Wonderful. Singularity Trap.
Written by Admiral Akbar.
That was good. I wouldn't have thought to say that, Evan, because we kind of implied it, but that was good.
Thanks, Jay. What is going on? It's so passive.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Last week, I played this noisies.
That's lovely.
What is it? What is this?
Are they puffins?
Is it an adorable animal?
The person that sent it in, his first sentence of the email was, noisies. No, that was not a puffin.
It's not an adorable animal?
Well, not really, no.
No.
Is it a tasty animal?
I got a couple of yes, it is. I got a couple of emails. This one is from a listener named Jay in Boston, and he said, this week's noisy is unfamiliar to me, but it kind of sounds like the radio signal from a pulsar.
That's not a tasty animal.
No, that's right.
Nope.
You're right.
A pulsar.
Scott Jensen said, Jay, probably wrong, but this week's Who's That Noisy sounds like one of those cackling witch Halloween decorations with a damaged soundbox. Man, is he right, Bob, or what?
Bob wouldn't know. Sure about that one either.
I love that. Well, it definitely sounds like a laughing voice box that's been damaged. I've heard that in all the years we've done Halloween.
About 12 weeks to Halloween, Bob, right?
Holy crap, is it that? No.
All right, another listener sent in a guest, Brian Walter, said, sounds like frogs I used to hear in the woods of Louisiana. Man, Brian, that was a good guess. I have heard frogs that kind of do sound like that, and I thought that you were the closest, but nobody won. Paul Fry sent in this noisy, and he said, this is a laughing crab.
What?
Yep, this bizarre sound is made from an irritated hermit crab.
What? I used to have hermit crabs. They never sounded like that.
Did you ever irritate them?
Yes. His next sentence was
probably not.
They only made this sound when picked up or disturbed.
Yeah, but I picked them up sometimes.
There you have that.
A disturbed hermit crab.
Yes.
Really?
He's very angry at
disturbed
you.
As in somebody has disturbed him, not like he is disturbed.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. we don't know that for sure. We may never know that.
True. Maybe that's why his hermit crab sounds different.
So it was a critter who lives near the water, so I had that.
And also, hermit crabs are adorable, thank you.
And edible.
No, they're not. Ew. People eat hermit crab?
Don't they?
They do?
I don't eat crab, but someone eats crab.
No, hermit crabs you hear them laughing? Like regular crabs.
They're laughing. I have a new noisy this week.
All right. So much for the crab.
This noisy was sent in by Jim Sherlock. That's a cool last name.
I don't know, but whatever it is, it fell apart after launch.
It sounds like there's a chemical reaction involved in there somewhere.
This is a fun one. Jim Sherlock. My only hint will be that I do believe that Jim recorded this himself.
Okay, interesting.
That's a good hint.
If you heard a cool noise this week or you think you know the answer to this week's noisy, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. One email this week. This email comes from Stephen Hopkinson from Waterford, Michigan. And Stephen writes, this past weekend, I was having a discussion with a friend about organic farming. Always a mistake. And land use. I mentioned that we already are using virtually all of the world's arable land and can't afford to use land inefficiently. My friend scrunched up his nose and asked, where did you hear that? It's not the first time that I have dropped that factoid and been challenged about it. Unfortunately, I was doing something that you should never do, just repeating something that I heard somewhere. In this case, the somewhere is the SGU. Steve has stated that arable land claim several times. I have accepted it and repeated it without doing a deep dive myself. This morning, I decided to do a shallow dive and found that, as with most things, this issue appears to be more complicated than the fact, as I have stated it to my friends. Indeed, there is even disagreement over the definition of arable land, so I'm hoping that you all can shed some additional light by providing a source for the claim or maybe even some more detailed explanation. All right, I did do that, Stephen. I wrote a whole blog post about it. It is, of course, always more complicated than you think, and it does turn on how you define arable land. So the basic definition of arable land is land that you could farm on, right? That you can grow stuff on.
Reasonable.
But of course, this is not a black or white thing, right? The question is, well, how usable does the land have to be before you consider it arable, right? Yeah. There might be some land which is technically arable. You could theoretically grow stuff on it, but it's not really useful for farming.
You could grow enough food for your own family, maybe.
Or just like you can grow one thing. Like, yeah, that you could grow you could grow olive trees on that land, but nothing else.
Gotcha.
Or it's just really minimally productive. It's just not going to be useful. But you could theoretically grow stuff on it. So let's start with the few objective numbers that we have here. Right now, we are using 11% of all the land on Earth for farming, right? 1.5 billion hectares out of 13.4 billion. So that's just 11% of all the land that there is on the earth. So the question is, what percent of that remaining 89% is arable, could theoretically be used for farming? And again, the answer to that, now all the objective numbers end, because the answer to that is it depends. So, and there's a range. There's a range of estimates depending on where you draw the line. The maximal estimate of how much land is potentially useful is 64% of all theoretically arable land. In other words, so the maximal estimate of arable land that we could use that we're not currently using is about 2.7 billion hectares, or 64% of potentially arable land, meaning that you're currently using 36%, 64% remains. That's the maximal estimate. However, at the other end of the spectrum, there are estimates that say that we only have about 3%, 2 to 3% arable land that's unused. So why such a huge range? So first of all, of that 2.7 billion hectares of land that is theoretically arable but not currently used for farming, forests cover 45% of it. So that would mean you would have to cut down forest in order to farm. Some of it is protected areas like wetland, about 12%, and 3% people are settling there. People are, their houses on it, you know, people are living there. So 60% of it, of that 64%, right, or 60% of that 2.7 billion hectares of potentially arable land really is not, you shouldn't count that. We can farm on it, you know, unless you're saying, yeah, it's okay to cut down the rainforest or to displace people from their homes in order to farm the land. If you count cutting down the rainforest, then there's lots of arable land, right? Obviously, we're not including that when we say we're using all the arable land that's available. And I can't remember exactly how I've stated it before, but there's always a little caveat in there, or, you know, the you know, usable arable land. You shouldn't count cutting down forests or displacing people or ignoring protected lands, right? So that cuts it down by 60% right there. Then there's also other land that is marginal, is basically the rest of it. Marginal meaning that it's technically arable, but it's not really good for farming.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So the other thing is about most of this unused arable land, 90% of it is in either sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America. And much of that is, of course, either wetlands or forested or whatever. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit in Asia. There's virtually none in Europe or North America. You know, this is why the estimates are so variable. I do think that the real estimate is about 3%. There's 3% of usable arable land that we could expand into, which is, and most of that is in Africa and some in South America. And that's it. But again, this all depends on where, there's no 100% objective place to draw the line on what we would consider practical. But that, I think, is probably a reasonable estimate. Now, of course, this is all, because unfortunately, this has huge propaganda implications, right? If you want to make the case that, oh, we don't have land to spread into, you know, we're basically using all the practically usable arable land that there is. There's only a little bit, you know, to expand into. You can use those numbers. If you want to say, we got plenty of land, don't worry about it, you could use this ridiculous number that includes, you know, using wetlands and displacing people from their homes and cutting down the rainforest. But obviously we're...
And rainforests.
Yeah, right. But you know, that... But then you could technically say use those numbers.
We're cutting it down,
right?
Enough already.
Yeah.
Exactly.
But we're... The other thing is we are... Obviously, we're using the good arable land, right? Which makes sense. Why would people plant a farm on crappy but technically arable land when there's really good arable land available? So the greater the percentage of theoretically arable land that we spread into, we're going to be going using less and less and less practical arable land.
So Steve, I have a question.
Yeah.
When you were looking at that, and I don't know if this is listed or if it's included as ag land, but what percentage of the available or the potential arable land is actually used for grazing or for commercial farming of animals for meat?
Yeah, so I don't think that includes grazing. I think that's...
Okay, because I think that's a big part of at least American agriculture. Like, I think there's huge swaths of land that are dedicated to either grazing or to factory farming. And it seems like if we change the percentage of the sources of our diet, there would be a way to use more arable land.
Well, but for land that's used for grazing is generally not good for farming. So there's not,
like, because it's become fallow from grazing.
No, it's just it's land that's not really usable as a farm, but grass can grow there, you know, but you would never farm there. It's on a hill, you know what I mean? Like, cows can walk up and down.
Do you think that's true currently, or do you think that was historically true?
No, that is currently true. That most of the grazing land is not really useful for farming.
But factory farming is massive. It's way more than grazing
land. Yeah, but a lot of that is – but the real question is how much farmland are we using to grow feed to feed those animals?
True. And, yeah, that's massive to grow corn and soy.
Yeah, I think that's really the issue you want to make. I don't think the grazing land – I don't think that's a good point because
– I don't think that many animals graze anymore in our food supply.
Well, there's grass-fed beef. You can get that. But I mean
– some, yeah. Yeah.
I don't know those percentages. That'd be another yeah. rabbit hole to go down. But
for sure.
Yeah, there's no question.
Yeah, you're right.
There is no question that if we wanted to reduce our agricultural footprint on the planet, one of the things that we could do is reduce the amount of meat that we eat and shift to micro farming of insects and things like that. So the other thing is, but I think the bottom line is no matter how you parse these numbers, I think that we want to use less land, right?
Yeah.
So right now we're using 11% of all the land on the earth. And I think by reasonable estimates, most of the best arable land, if you want to put it that way, we cannot easily and not without making sacrifices expand into other land. And in any case, the biggest negative impact we have on the environment is just the fact that we are using land for farming, right? That's land that could be milkweed to, you know, milk thistle to feed the butterflies or whatever, right? It could be that part of the natural ecosystem. We're basically cutting down whatever the natural ecosystem would be there and planting rows of monocrops, right? So that's the biggest impact. And so we should be motivated. If you care about the environment, right? Mm. You would want to minimize the use of land, for agriculture. And so, but it's it's interesting. Every time I touch upon this or I write upon it, so many people give the standard line of, we don't need to reduce land use. All we need to do is X, right? We already grow enough food to feed everybody, or we just need to cut out waste, or we don't, whatever. It's all a false choice, you know?
Yeah.
No, fine. Let's be more efficient and, you know, think about ways of reducing the amount of meat that we're eating. And those things are fine, but there's no reason not to also get the maximal food production for the land that we are using. And if we could decrease the amount of land that we were using, that land could eventually, you know, be reincorporated into the natural ecosystem. This is why one of the reasons why I am actively against organic farming. The best evidence we have shows that organic diets use between 20 and 40% more land to support than conventional. Diets. And that's even taking the meat into effect, you know?
Which is like, it's fine if you're talking about your family farm. It's time if you're talking about growing in your own backyard. That's great. But
yeah, my backyard garden is basically organic, you know? We're not talking about just cranking out the calories, you know, to feed the world. The other thing that we forget, this is why it's such a privileged thing, like organic, you know, eating. I only eat organic. We actually don't have enough land on the earth to give every, you know, 7.5 billion people the USDA recommended diet. Right. So you think we have enough food to feed everybody? No, we don't. We don't make enough food to feed everybody. If you're counting feeding everybody as giving them what Americans are eating and not what we're overeating, the minimum USDA recommended nutrition. We can't get there unless we increase the efficiency of our agricultural production, right? And all of this ultimately is about not just organic, it's also about GMOs, right?
Of course.
Yeah, because
– yeah. And everybody for some reason wants to equate GMOs with monocropping. Like they make all these arguments that they think they're making about GMOs.
Yeah, it's all –
but it's really just about modern agriculture.
Yeah, exactly. I don't like to patent food. Well, then you're against every hybrid seed out there because they're all patented. You know, it's like nothing – yeah.
Yeah. It is a hybrid.
Hybrid.
But anyway, yeah, this is a rabbit hole, but I think that's as fair a summary as I could give of it. And it does turn on where you draw the line of what's practical arable land. All right, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake-a-rooney. You guys ready for this week?
Yep.
Yep.
All righty. 3 regular news items, no theme. You guys are doing really well this year. I think your percentages are going to be up. You swept me last week.
Nah, I got swept the week before, though.
Yeah. I have to up my game somehow.
Hmm.
Why do you have to up your game? Just keep doing what you're doing.
Clearly, I'm not being challenging enough.
Because we're getting better.
Yeah, I think you guys are getting better.
Smack us down.
Yep.
Is that called moving the goalposts?
That's the way it works. All right, here we go. Archaeologists have identified the oldest sample of solid cheese from an Egyptian tomb dating to the 13th century BCE. Item number 2, a new psychological study finds that displaying status symbols actually deter friendship. And item number 3, in a new survey of exoplanet systems, astronomers find that Earth's makeup of elements is atypical.
Atypical?
Atypical, meaning not typical.
I know what it means.
All right, Bob, then go first.
For the record, I think this is the second week in a row of me going first, but I shall soldier on with this slap in the face. So let's see. Number 1,
yes,
archaeologists
opened your mouth.
A sample of solid cheese. See, and I thought I had some immunity because I went first last week, but no.
And you were late.
You're never going
to you were the last duck late to get onto the ship, so you got a whack in the ass.
You calling me Ping? Was that the duck's name? Ping?
Yeah,
that's right,
Ping.
Bob.
Oh,
man. Ping. So nostalgic. All right, so let's look at this first one. The oldest sample of solid cheese, Egyptian tomb. They found a lot of great stuff, like lentils comes to mind, and cheese doesn't surprise me. 13th century BCE. Wow. Okay, that's pretty old. So let's look at this, but I'm kind of leaning towards that one as being science. Let's see, number 2, psychological study. Displaying status symbols actually deter friendships. Oh, you mean like a Maserati, a nice car?
Yeah.
Deter friendship. Yeah. I could see how that would make some sort of psychological sense, how that would deter friendships. So let's see. The exoplanet system. Earth is not typical in terms of its makeup compared to other exoplanets. I don't know about that one. I mean, the whole sweep of history is kind of like we're not unusual. You know, life is just, we're not a special place. We're not the center of anything. So that one kind of rubs me the wrong way. Yeah, I'll say that the Earth is atypical is fiction.
Okay, Evan.
Ooh, solid cheese. Solid cheese as opposed to string cheese or shredded cheese or Parmesan cheese. And that is some old funky cheese. Wonder what that smelled like when they found that sample. Like, whoa. Or it's just, you know, or it's so encrusted with its own, you know, organic outer layer that it doesn't smell like anything. It smells like stone. I think that one's right. Displaying status symbols actually deter friendships. Okay. Yeah, I could see a case made for that. People become jealous or, you know, a little envious, and that could have an effect on that. But the Earth's makeup of elements atypical in the exoplanet systems. Well, don't they talk a lot about finding Earth-like planets? Now, I'm not sure if they're just referring to size. I always thought that they were referring to just more than that. Also some, you know, the atmosphere makeup, you know, nitrogen, oxygen, perhaps those sorts of things. But I'll go with Bob again. It worked for me last week. I'll do it again this week. Earth's makeup of elements atypical fiction.
Kara, go next.
I think I'm not going to go with you guys.
Okay, Kara.
I'm scared, though, because when I did this before, I was screwed. But then again, I went first. And going first, you always are sucking. Not always, but often.
Are you going to go with the cheese one?
No, I agree with the cheese one. I think it's the status symbols one. I don't think there's enough information, first of all. This is very misleading because it says a new psychological study finds that displaying status symbols actually deter friendship, but it says nothing about whether that's in first making friends or in maintaining a friendship.
I'll tell you, it's in first making friends.
Yeah, I think that displaying status symbols absolutely makes people want to be around you more. So I think that this one is actually the fiction.
Wow.
Okay, and Jay.
This one about the archaeologists finding the cheese, yes, they found old cheese. No big deal. The second one here that Kara says, you know, if you overbling your friends, they are going to think you're not cool.
And this last one here, survey says the exoplanet systems.
Survey says.
Astronomers find that Earth's makeup of elements is atypical. I do not believe that our makeup is atypical. I really don't.
Oh, God, I'm all alone.
So I'm going to GW.
Go with the cheese. Go with the cheese.
Come on, Jay. Cut the cheese. Cut the cheese.
I've been. I ate half a bag of cherries yesterday. So, yes, I am cutting the cheese. No. what we have here, Steve.
Yes.
Is a. It's typical. Failure. It's division of the sexes.
Oh. Yeah. Oh.
Okay. There is something about the status symbol thing here that makes Kara think that that one is the fake. And there is something about. The atypical, the probably just that word atypical that Bob, Evan, and I, it's rubbing us the wrong way.
Yeah, but Kara is the psychologist.
I'm like, right. Yeah,
but I haven't read this study, so you never know, man. And all also, right. It's just one new study.
And she loves cheese.
All right, well,
and I am the pseudo-astronomer.
So let's start with the one you all agree with. Archaeologists have identified the oldest sample of solid cheese from an Egyptian tomb dating to the 13th century BCE. You all think that one is science, the 3,300-year-old cheese.
Oh, my gosh.
And that one is science.
Ooh, yay.
That was cool.
What if it came with an expiration date?
The world's oldest cheese.
Didn't we just recently find the world's oldest bread, too?
Maybe.
Oh, we could have a party.
So. Yeah.
So this was in the tomb of P-T-A-H-M-E-S. What is that? Tammies?
Fatmes? Oh, Tammies.
P-T-A-H-M-E-S. He was the mayor of Memphis in Egypt during the 13th century B.C.,
And BCE, the big cheese.
Was initially unearthed in 1885, but then his tomb was covered by sand drifts and then was rediscovered in 2010. And when the archaeologists were investigating it, they found some jars. In one of those jars, which was covered by some canvas fabric, there was this white substance. And when they examined the white substance, they found that it was cheese, a mixture of cow milk and either sheep or goat milk. And then plus the way it was stored, you know, the canvas wouldn't really have held the liquid. So it probably, you know, everything fits with the fact that that was stored solid cheese. So that would be the oldest sample of solid cheese known to man. So cheese has a very long history. We probably were making cheese as long as we were using dairy, right? Because cheese is really the only way to store dairy products for a long period of time, especially in warm climates. They would heavily salt it. You know, they would, you know, cheese is basically curdled milk. And they did use the organs like the stomachs of animals to store food. So probably storing their curdled cheese or their milk in calf stomachs, they realized that, hey, this cheese is better, you know, than the cheese that we're just, you know, curdling milk without storing it in a calf stomach. And that's because calf stomachs make rennet, and rennet's an enzyme that turns cheese into – that turns milk into the curd and the whey, right? It turns it into the cheese.
Neat.
And the liquidy substance that's left over after the cheese. Yeah, so that's probably what led to, you know, modern cheese making. And then, of course, when the longer the cheese is around, then it can – you can get like bacteria and yeast in there, which can affect the flavor. And so, and then the, you know, the cheddar cheeses of the world were born.
And goat cheese.
The earliest evidence of cheese making goes back to about 6,000 years BCE. So even a, you know, few thousand years before this Egyptian cheese. The earliest direct evidence goes to 5,500 BCE in Poland, actually. And then just like, oh, they're probably, you know, the indirect evidence a little bit further. So yeah, so that's, you know, 7,500 years we've been making cheese.
Jesus.
Like you do.
No, cheese is awesome. I love cheese. Think about it. And it is one of those
cheese is awesome.
You know, the ability to store that kind of food for months.
Important.
Was hugely important.
Oh,
it's like beef jerky.
Big advantage.
It was like massive.
Yeah. Salting beef, you know, meats.
Yeah, salted meat.
Yeah.
All right, let's move on to number two. A new psychological study finds that displaying status symbols actually deter friendship. Carrie, you think this one is the fiction. The guys think this one.
No.
Yeah, this one is science.
I hate
and
this part of
this
the show.
This one is
hoo-hoo.
Science. Sorry,
Carrie.
Jay, it's funny that you use the term bling because the title, the headline, did you read it? The headline of the phys.org press release was forget the bling, high status signaling deters new friendships. So this is new friendships, which is why I clarified that for you, Kara. They didn't study the effect on business relationships or on, you know, mating or new or existing friendships. This was just, you know, they had people display either mundane items or more expensive items, and then they were, you know, rated by other people. And they even tried to control for whether or not it was the expense, like, are people put off by how expensive the items are? And so they had people to pick and wear one of two t-shirts, one of which had Walmart written in plain script on it. The other one had Saks Fifth Avenue written on it, but they were both t-shirts, right? So these were not luxury items. 76% of participants who presented themselves as new friends chose to wear the t-shirt that said Saks Fifth Avenue, but 64% of the would-be friends chose the person wearing the Walmart t-shirt. So people,
this is such a terrible study.
People chose.
This is so not representative of the real world.
That was just that was just one study. That the people tended to choose the higher status items, thinking that would help them, but actually it was correlated with not being, you know, chosen as a new friend or whatever in this paradigm.
Yes, thank you. In this paradigm.
In this paradigm.
This horrible, horrible paradigm.
Like all psychological studies, right?
Kara, I know what your I know what your doctorate thesis is going to be on. It's going to be on this, about this study.
I actually already chose my dissertation. It's very far from this, but yes, this is horrible. This is a horrible, horrible study.
Fair enough. All right. All this means that in a new survey of exoplanet systems, astronomers find that Earth's makeup of elements is atypical. That is the fiction, because they found that it's exactly normal. That the Earth, in terms of the types of elements that are present and the proportions, it seems to be pretty typical of other solar systems out there. So, yeah, there's no reason.
Again, wonderful for the potential of life.
And you guys hit upon the principle here, which is that it's always good to assume that there's nothing special about the Earth, about our solar system, about our galaxy, about our place in the universe, that we're probably average, you know, statistically speaking. That's always a good default assumption. And in this case, we have empirical evidence that at least in terms of the kind of stuff that's making up our solar system, that we're pretty typical. And what that means is that for this part of our galaxy, for stars that have planets around them, right, then the elements should be similar. At different places in the galaxy, the makeup is probably different, right? There's more metallicity as you get closer to the core, you know, of the galaxy, for example. There's higher metal counts. And if you get too far out, there'd be less metal. And then also,
really?
Yeah, first generation stars obviously don't have all the higher, you know, higher elements, but second and third generation stars have more. So
why would there be more such stars? Why more second and third generation stars towards the core and more first generation stars?
I didn't say that.
The rim?
These are two separate things. These are two totally separate things.
But you said closer to the core,
there's higher metallicity. No, there's higher metallicity. Right. Even if you're comparing second generation and second generation stars, there's just higher metallicity toward in the gas clouds that are making those stars. So it's just the distribution of these elements in the galaxy.
That makes sense, actually, because you've got denser, more stars the closer you get to the core, therefore more enrichment of the clouds from supernova and stuff. Okay.
So this was a survey of 18 different planetary systems out to 456 light years away. So these are in our backyard. These are the local part of the galaxy, which is probably why they look similar. If we were looking at solar systems that were thousands of light years away, they probably would have different ratios. So this makes sense. This makes perfect sense.
Right. And yet we're typical, and yet we're probably the only life in the universe. Don't get me started.
At the same time? It's a bit of a paradox.
We won't go down that rabbit hole again.
Not until a few weeks have passed.
Yeah. Yeah, I got to give it at least a couple weeks. So good job, guys. Sorry, Kara.
Yeah.
I do respect you, though, for going out on your own. And
definitely.
Yeah. It just
going
really,
with your gut.
I would love to see this study done in a more naturalistic way.
Of course.
I don't know if it would turn out that way. I think that this is all social desirability bias. I think that's all that study tested.
Mm-hmm, perhaps.
So, yeah. I'd be interested to see somebody try and reproduce it in a naturalistic way. Yep. Do it, people.
Do it now.
I'm not doing it, though. My dissertation's way more interesting than that.
Kara, when I get it wrong, Steve does not say anything to make me feel better. I just want to.
Aww.
Nope.
That's true.
There's a little bit of shock.
I tend to rub it in.
Flat out.
I tend to rub it in more, yeah. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
When the brain is released from the constraints of reality, it can generate any sound, image, or smell in its repertoire, sometimes in complex and impossible combinations. And that was written by Oliver Sacks.
Aww.
The late, great Oliver Sacks, whom I know you were very fond of.
That's true. You know, you have these weird dreams. And you can analyze them when you wake up and you're like, how did my brain assemble all of that? Like the weirdest scenario and visuals and connections between things that really don't have any connection with each other.
Not even dreams.
You don't
what
need
I,
to be what asleep,
I notice
right?
is, yeah, if I'm like tired, I'm falling asleep. Like I'll be just thinking about stuff. And then as I drift off, my stream of consciousness gets totally bizarre. And then I wake up and I remember what I was just thinking, you know, while I was drifting off. Like, what the hell? How did my brain go there? Right? It's like the stream of consciousness gets really crazy when you're drifting off to sleep.
Have you ever had the illusion of someone saying your name or calling you on something? You swear that somebody, someone in your family called you or said something?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's happened to me a lot. You can induce that. Think of your name as you're drifting off. And then when the times I've tried that, at some point you will hear somebody say your name, like right in your ear, like an amazingly, realistic, like, oh boy, that was
It's
cool.
a startling sensation. I, you know, gets shaken by it almost. Like, did I really hear what I just heard? Like, and I have to go figure out what's going on, only to find out it was an illusion.
In the same week, I read Gratitude by Oliver Sacks and Mortality by Chris Hitchens. Both very good pre-death reflective essays, mm-hmm. if you guys are ever interested. They're beautiful.
The first one of his I read, I think it was The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat.
Me too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Classic. Me too. Yeah. That was awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, guys. Thanks for joining me this week.
You're welcome. Good to be joined to you.
Thanks.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.